Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C, a host of the channel. And today I'll be talking with Dr. Rana Tarayeva and Dr. Rustam Urambayev, who have recently co-edited a volume called Labor, Mobility, and Informal Practices in Russia, Central Asia, and Eastern Europe, Power, Institutions, and Mobile Actors in Transnational Space. Rana Tarayeva is a senior scholar affiliated with the Institute for Social and Cultural Anthropology at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, and is an associated senior researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Halle-Saale, Germany. Her first monograph on migration and was on migration and identity in Uzbekistan and was published in with Rutledge in 2016. And she's currently finishing her second monograph, which is titled Migration and Islam in Russia. Dr. Rustam Urambayev is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology of Law at Lund University, and he is also a senior researcher in Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Alexandria Institute at the University of Helsinki. In addition to this book, he is currently co-writing a new book called The Political Economy of Non-Western Regimes, Migration and Legal Informality in Russia and Turkey, which is due to come out next year. Rana and Rustam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So I'm excited to sit down and talk with you about this book today, which is actually a series with Rutledge and published in partnership with the British Association for Slavic and East European Studies. Of course, the book itself deals with Russia, Central Asia, and Eastern Europe, looks at issues including labor, mobility, and informal practices in all of these spaces. To help contextualize this work, I was hoping you could share a little bit about how you came up with this project and how it relates to some of your previous and future research. Some listeners in particular might notice some similarities between this book and a previous book we discussed with you, Rustam, but we'd like to hear a little bit more about your projects and your research kind of trajectory. So let's start with Rustam.
I think this book project, as in my view, this is a spontaneous process. A couple of years ago, Rano, I think it was 2018, Rano contacted me with a proposal to organize a workshop on migration and informality in Central Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And at that time, it was difficult to get funding for a workshop from German funding agencies. And then I proposed that we can try to get funding from Swedish Riksbanken's Jubileums Fund. And then this is how the idea of this book was born. And then we applied for workshop funding and we got money. And then after some time, I think it was March 2018, if I'm not mistaken, we organized first international workshop on migration and informality in Central Eastern Europe and Central Asia. This was the beginning of our long journey. And then after 1 year, again, we organized another workshop in Lund again with the financial support of Riksbank and Jubileumsfond. And then we again invited migration scholars, scholars studying labor, mobility, and informality in post-Soviet context, in Eastern Europe, Central Europe. And this is how we built this big team, which you find in this edited volume, 12 authors. And so this is how we started the project. But Rano, I think you can complement more and tell the details about this.
Thank you very much. I can tell you the prehistory. Prehistory was that Kea Schenk, she's also contributed, she invited me to a workshop which is called in Migration in Eurasia or something, Eurasian Migration, something like this, in Astana. So it was a very small workshop, like a round table discussion on the topic of migration in Eurasian space. So sitting there in this event, I was really, I had to reflect a lot on my past research, which has to do with migration, informal economies. We were discussing a lot of other colleagues' topics on the similar issues. And while I was discussing there with the colleagues about my past research on migration, informal economies, I somehow started there to think about, but the link between, we talk about migration all the time, but I started more to think about mobilities because I was looking at mobile actors who are going beyond national boundaries, so transnational actors more specifically. So I was thinking more about mobilities than migration, sitting in this migration workshop, and then informality. I participated in very different projects on informality until then, until 2017, until I started my research in Russia. So it came to my mind that this link between mobilities and informality, somehow I didn't much find in its systematic form in the literature. And that's how this idea came to my mind while sitting and discussing with the colleagues. And then Rustam was really kind to find the funding. And then we had this event. And as he said, it evolved. This idea took shapes. And at the end, it became this book. So I think that's a prehistory of the idea.
So it took 3 years to get this out with two workshops in Lund and a lot of co-editing work and processes with getting a book contract. So this is, I think it was a very exciting process.
And I want to dive a little bit deeper because it's pretty interesting to hear that a lot of these three main concepts that kind of circulate in the book, labor, mobility, and informality, are kind of coming not just from your own kind of research, but actually from a lot of conversations with a lot of different people in a lot of different places, right? Like, this is pretty interesting. And I think to some extent, labor is pretty clear. We'll talk about this. We'll talk about this, what you mean by labor, why labor is important to study, but I think it's a clear choice. I'm more interested right now in mobility, this conversation that Rana was just reflecting on, which is mobility versus migration. And I'd like you guys to talk a little bit more about that, kind of why mobility, and then also what similarities do we kind of see in these mobility regimes? What are these mobility regimes, as you call them, in the Commonwealth of Independent States, the European Union, and the Eurasian Economic Union? Because this is kind of one of the threads that you try to unite these different regions. And we know that Rustem is actually working on a project where he also looks at these processes in Turkey. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about mobility versus migration and how What similarities we see across these different spaces?
So Rano can comment on this.
Yeah, Rana.
Okay. Sure. I mean, as I said, I already started some preliminary ideas that how I started to think about mobility. So I was doing research on migration in internal migration in Uzbekistan, and then I went to Russia and did my research on migration, Central Asian migration to Russia, and that's also how I started writing about transnational actors and mobile entrepreneurs. So I published several works on mobile entrepreneurs, and that's how I came to understand the problem of how these mobilities challenge existing nation state models, which we are used to so far. And also the within this migration literature, also the start of the discussion or analysis is about how the national state regulate migration policies. And these are kind of very much or largely imprisoned within these nation state systems and legal systems, which are within nation states. Yeah. And of course, transnationalism literature is not new. I mean, Nina Glick-Schiller and others, they built until now, it's a huge literature on transnationalism and how this transnationalization of networks work and how these national groups interact beyond these borders. But this is also very much largely about engagement with the home country and all these nationality and identity questions, which are largely discussed within this literature. But in my research, when I was looking at the economic activities, like when it had to do with banking systems, money transfers, or other kinds of channels which would actually need, which would actually deal with the regulation itself. There is still a lot of literature on that, but it was still kind of a something which was necessary to engage further in my eyes, because you have this kind of state. Nation state models which not always accommodate all these transnational economic activities which I was looking at until I came to the project. And that's why mobility is much more open. I mean, mobility turn, we know it's also not new with URI and others who are starting to challenge all kinds of contexts in the area of mobility turn, as it's discussed in the literature. So mobility is a much more opening up these rigid nation state models, which don't always accommodate this kind of very complex situations we are dealing with. If it's a transnational labor migration, if it's seasonal labor, if it's a mobile labor, if it's other kinds of activities of different kinds of entrepreneurship. So that's why mobilities and migration. So, I mean, of course, in the book, we have different models and different examples of different kinds of migrations, but these all could kind of contribute to understanding mobility more. And to the question of how informality comes into play is that when you start talking about that the state, nation state models or legal systems which do not anymore accommodate all the economic activity which is happening on one place, but these economic activities are happening in different locales, then of course what is not accommodated within the legal system is then somehow happening or take place or accommodated within the informal spaces. Here we talk about informal regulations. Here we talk about informal economies. Here we talk about informal practices of different kind. Here we talk about different actors as well.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, mobility allows you to talk about informality as well, but essentially addresses that main problem, which is people are not just moving from one nation state to the other anymore, that it's a much more complex process and people are moving in different kinds of ways, right?
Yes, that's why, I mean, that enables us to somehow to analyze this kind of very complex situation of mobility and all this labor mobility in our cases, of course. Many cases are from labor mobility examples. There are, of course, other practices which we included in the book, but this is how we could include very diverse examples in order to understand what is the linking part of informality and mobility, in order to understand these two concepts together.
Great. Yeah, and I think we'll dive more into that once we get down to the sections on mobility and informality, because basically I want to structure the rest of our talk today about the different sections of the book, which are labor mobility and informality. And so this first section on, let's start with this first section on labor, which deals with a range of topics. You have like an ethnographic study of taxi drivers in Tashkent, labor relations between Russian business and migrant workers, a study on deportation regimes in contemporary Russia, which was co-authored by you, Rana, and also a chapter which deals with informality within Romanian communities, kind of working in the German construction and meat processing sectors. And what unites these stories, which is interesting because, you know, we sit back and we think, what do these stories all have in common, especially Romanians in Germany? Like, can we draw comparisons? But your answer is yes, we can. And what unites these stories is uncertainty, legal uncertainty, dealing with lack of documentation, weak rule of law from the state perspective, and shadow economies. So my question for you is, how does this uncertainty link these various case studies, and what are some of the major differences between them? This is the Central Asian Studies channel, so I'm particularly interested in comparing kind of the Central Asian case, both in Central Asia and also Central Asians who are in Russia or elsewhere, and kind of comparing them with this broader East European or even European context. Let's start with that. So
I can start and then Rustam can continue. I think what I dealt in my research with uncertainty and trust was coming out as the central themes. When you consider people who leave their safe networks at home, they immediately face uncertainties in the context of even within their own countries. When they start traveling, they are uncertain about what kind of documents they should carry, if they will be stopped, where shall they stay, where shall they leave, do they have enough money? Because, I mean, the migration policies in no country in Central Asia or in Russia, taking as an example, for example, these migration policies are not in places, so that in order to somehow regulate any kind of mobility within the country or incoming mobilities, for example. So, I mean, since these systems are not there and social welfare systems are not there, we have to do a lot with uncertainty. And, I mean, informal arrangements is full of uncertainty because there is no security of any kind. So that produces very uncertain decisions and uncertain strategies of all kinds. And I think it has a lot of implications also for social relations and security questions, as I said. Sorry, I have to connect the cable. So these systems that we are dealing with, or these situations that we are dealing with, is full of uncertainty. And in the situation of uncertainty, of course, as a resulting question which arises is trust. Can I trust someone? Can I trust this person or this other person to work with, or who hires me, or whom I can trust other things? Yeah, and these things should be arranged outside of those systems which are not there. Mm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in this case, Russia, which doesn't have a lot of these kind of, I mean, we've talked about this before, Rustem, in your previous interview, but Russia, which doesn't have a lot of these, as you just said, Rana, these kind of systems for managing migration and mobility. I mean, in some way, this is how low-level corruption operates, and we know about that. Does this make Russia unique in some way, or do we see this in other places in Eastern Europe as well?
Can I comment on this?
Yeah, please.
I think you raised a very important question. You know, this part of this section of the book, Labor, deals with different socio-legal context. We have Uzbek context with a taxi driver, informal taxi drivers. Then we have Romanian and German context covered there through the case study of Romanian workers posted in Germany, German construction sector. And we have also Russian labor market with ambiguous legal system. And of course, the idea of, you know, bringing together these three different chapters covering different socio-legal contexts is to show that examples that we show in relation to uncertainty, precarious labor, and ambiguous legal system is not just unique to Russian case, but similar examples, you know, can be found in different socio-legal contexts. So we wanted to show that this comparative context also that the examples, you know, provided in this book is much broader than the post-Soviet case, but it can be found in different mobility regimes. If we connect to introduction, where we have Commonwealth of Independent States, Eurasian Economic Union, and European Union, and then these are different mobility regimes. But this precarious labor and then ambiguous legal system and uncertainty creates, you know, similar responses. Which migrants invent in order to migrants and as actors involved in the migration industry invent to cope with uncertainties. And then informality is, you see, it's a part of, you know, coping strategies in these four different chapters.
Mm-hmm. And so this is a story, way beyond the post-communist or post-Soviet world, but actually this is something that globally we see throughout the world.
Otherwise, informality is usually associated with global South or with the countries of post-Soviet space, but we see that it's a broader concept and it can be found also in the context of global North, where through the example of, for example, Romanian workers, you know, using different informal tactics, mechanisms, you know, to adapt to the labor market in Germany, for example.
Great. Thank you. For the next, I would like to switch over to mobility, which I think will be one of the most interesting sections of our interview, because I can tell this is what really stands behind the book in some ways. So this middle section, which I think is also about four chapters, deals with mobility, and it looks at how different actors and their mobility blurs boundaries. And this is something you talked about in the introduction. Including legal, informal, physical, geographic, digital, and real boundaries. So you have, again, here four studies. They deal with things like Uzbek migrant workers in Russia. So that's Rustem's chapter. A chapter on Central Asian female migrants in Russia. A chapter which looks at the development of a healing practices industry, looking at things like writing amulets, cupping therapy, and other sorts of kind of folk medicine, we might call it. And also a chapter on road regimes, which looks at how local and mobile people in a suburban Western Poland adapt, change, and maintain informal or semi-legal economic strategies. So my first question, what do you mean by mobility blurs boundaries? How do we make sense of this this claim?
May I start, Rano?
Yeah, sure. I can continue then. Okay.
The idea behind this, in my view, is that mobility blurs the boundaries in the sense that boundaries cannot be anymore understood in relation to physical boundaries. But due to the mobile livelihoods that many actors in different chapters, pursue in their everyday life, mobility also operates digitally through smartphones and social media. And this is what we wanted to show through the case of smartphones. And then not only the not only the people are involved in mobility. In these four different chapters, we also show that social norms, traditions, and healing practices also travel with migrants to their host countries. And this, healing practices, social norms, and informal social control mechanisms, which operate through smartphones and through the digital, boundaries, they shape the livelihood strategies of mobile actors in both home and host countries. So this is, central in my view, point that we want to show that mobility is both physical, encompasses both the physical and digital boundaries. Rano, maybe you can...
Yes, I can add to that or complement to that understanding of boundaries is very wide in the literature, of course, but when we talk about blurring boundaries of any kind, if we talk about formality or informality, like in this kind of binary visions of where the boundaries actually make sense or appear to be relevant, so then blurring is like it's kind of challenging those boundaries of different kind of definitions. What is formal actor and what is informal actor? If the state actor becoming informal actor, is that possible? Because, here is already the blurring of between formality and informality is there. So when we talk about blurring boundaries are about challenging this kind of divisions, challenging this kind of binary visions, challenging this kind of rigid understanding of anything. If we talk about in the context of mobility, for example, then we talk about changing systems. So, things like if we say, for example, state legal system, which is relevant for the national boundaries of Russia, do not make sense anymore because the activity is taking place in different countries and has to do with different legal systems. If it's Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Russia, then we are dealing with different kind of legal systems. And then you have then informal banking, for example, and very different actors. So all kinds of boundaries are getting blurred. And then I would like to come back to our key, one of the important concepts, I think, mobility regimes, is that what we mean by mobility regimes is a regime is, going back to Foucault, is something which is regulating, which has some regulating potential. So if we talk about mobility regimes in very different contexts, it can include all kinds of practices, institutions, and actors. Just take visa regulations or union regulations. If you talk about post-Soviet countries, for example, They have a very different kind of trade regulations and other visa regulations and internal regulations for example, labor mobility, for example, or refugee politics. If you want to take in a European Union, there you have a very formal and informal agreements between very different countries, which is included in refugee politics, for example. So this is a very wide range of practices, institutions, and actors which would like. We cannot, of course, show all of the examples which exist, which could be included into what we call mobility regimes, but we show some.
Well, and I wanted to ask a little bit further about what you were just talking about, because I think we're used to thinking about kind of institutional and legal constraints, right? Like the state. We're used to a state perspective, especially when we're talking about migrant workers. But I'm curious, because we're talking about how these new boundaries are being formed, mobility, kind of the way that mobility operates outside of the national state kind of context. So how does what kind of constraints do we see coming from transnational institutions, even if they're informal institutions or digital? You know, I guess the fact that we're using that the people we're talking about are using kind of digital networks to communicate, what are there any kind of constraints that this imposes on mobilities, or does this, what impact does this have on those mobilities? Maybe not just from a productive standpoint, but is there a limiting aspect to this as well?
Rustam, do you want to say something, or shall I just briefly start?
You can start and I can add.
Okay. We said that the banking system is not relevant. We said that the state legal systems are not always relevant, but they are there. You know, and all this regulation of visa regulations are there, propiska regulations are there, deportation regimes are there, border regulations are there. And I mean, the actors become more and more innovative to avoid those constraints, but these are there. And these are also part of those mobility regimes, which not only enable, but also constrain.
Yes, and this if you talk about digital boundaries, I think we have two case studies where in one case, we see that existence of digital technologies empower migrants in the sense that they are able to enforce contracts in Moscow's shadow economy. But in the case of female migrants, who work in different sectors of the Russian labor market, digital technologies have a disempowering effect in the sense that through digital technologies, gender inequality and hierarchies that you observe in Uzbek society are reproduced in a Russian labor market, and they limit the life chances and possibilities of female migrants. So we see that these digital technologies not only serving for facilitating migrants, but they have also negative consequences for the livelihoods of migrants in terms of imposing informal forms of social control in their daily lives. And this is what we wanted to show, this dynamics through not only the physical boundaries, but this digital technologies shaping the livelihoods of mobile workers in different contexts.
No, and I think that's a really good example of how, okay, the physical boundary, it still matters, but it maybe starts to matter a little bit less when you see that these communities can still be connected through this digital space. So that's a really great example. Thank you. If you're not opposed, we can maybe talk a little bit about informality, but I think there will be some overlap between these two topics, mobility and informality. I think we've touched on this a little bit, but to reiterate, informality, we're kind of talking about informality as a state, both as a state practice dealing with mobility, but also as a way that mobile actors react to the nation state. And these legal kind of constraints. So this section includes a chapter where you look at informal and formal practices, both as both part of a functioning state by exploring things like migration quotas and deportation. Another chapter, this was actually really interesting. You look at the Arctic route of Moscow through northern Russia, which was a major transit channel during through which migrants from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East traveled to the EU via Finland and Norway during the big migration, you know, refugee migrations in like the last decade. And then you have another chapter which takes us to Kazakhstan. Again, this is really interesting to see how things are developing in Central Asia, but you're looking at practices of informal healthcare and how these groups who are undocumented basically the state's coming in and trying to stop this practice of providing free healthcare for those people without documents, right? And to see how the reverse, again, the digitization of these technologies actually works for the state, but against certain groups, right? And then you also have this chapter dual citizenship in Georgia and Azerbaijan with these Meskhetian Turks. It specifically looks at Georgia in 2007 when there's this legal attempt to return them to Turkey. And then there's this round of new citizenship laws, but basically you see increasing bureaucratic hurdles for this minority group. And they have to develop their own kind of informal practices and transnational lifestyles to kind of operate outside of the nation state's sort of legal boundaries. So this is kind of a summary of each of these cases, but I'm curious to hear from you how informality operates at the state level in these various cases, and how we can kind of connect this with the broader space that we're talking about in the book, specifically about the state acting informally.
I think I can start since I have a chapter together with Izzet Aman. And so on deportation regimes, they clearly, you can see how state uses the legal tools to enforce informal practices of deportation. So in our chapter, we deal with the deportation cases that Izzet was defending as a lawyer, and on the court proceedings where I also participated. So there you can see there is these new regulations which really, I mean, the legal analysis made by Izzet, he's a lawyer, where he shows some contradictions within the laws, within the Russian law system. And beyond that, the practice itself, like fining the people, entering the people's administrative punishments into the system, and how the system works on the level of deportation within the deportation system, how the court operates, how the application works, and then how the actual deportation happens. This has to do with several laws that we are citing in the chapter, for example, which contradict anyway, content-wise, they contradict to other laws that exist in the Russian legal system. But then if you analyze all the practices around, within, and all the documentation and the actual deportation, so you see a lot of illegal practices which are performed by state actors, which doesn't fit to any kind of regulations of, for example, appeal system, for example, which is ignored. The length of applications and until actual deportation, for example, which are also regulated within the same laws, doesn't make any sense if you analyze how the deportation is actually conducted. So this is a very clear example how state actors act illegally against their own laws. So, I mean, these are, I think, the best example to show this.
I actually have some follow-up questions because this is a really interesting topic. And so two things came to mind. One is, you know, we're talking about the Russian state, but you do occasionally see that Russian states and Central Asian states are actually working together to kind of enforce this. So how does that work? And second, obviously, it's very difficult to avoid the deportation regime if once they have their kind of eyes set on you, right? What, from your experience, what strategies can or do mobile people develop in response to these kinds of deportation?
I think Rustam has very nice examples for that. So.
Sure.
Yeah, it's of course. I think I also argue in my book in Migration and Hybrid Political Regimes that on the one hand, the legal system is very restrictive, and if you from a legal centralistic perspective, it gives the idea that migrants are passive actors and without any agency. But on the other hand, the same legal system with weak rule of law and corruption allows migrants to invent different informal strategies to navigate the legal restrictions, in the sense that this is a system that with both with carrots and sticks, you know. So this is a contradiction, more or less a paradox of the Russian legal system. In our book, in this edited volume, we have also interesting examples from Keris Shank. She has a chapter in the last section in informality where she shows how the informal practices of the Russian state actors produces informal migration governance system where different interests are reconciled. By informal practices, Russian state officials are creating a scarce formal labor force which is submissive and legally unprotected, and also at the same time this is also a signal to the society, to the xenophobic groups in the society, that Russian state is doing, and there is a strict legal system which is controlling migrants and deporting them. So then these xenophobic tendencies are satisfied. On the other hand, the same system allows migrants to navigate the system. And so we have different actors involved benefiting from this informal governance system, which you can observe. And then a chapter by Joni Vikkunen and Mina Pipponen, I think this is a very good example. Again, that informal practice of Russian state officials, to some extent facilitated the production of Arctic Road, because Russian state officials were indirectly involved in the emergence of this new migration refugee route to European Union through Finnish and Norwegian borders. So we have these different, chapters, and then they show that the more you regulate, the more you incentive you create for informality. So this, of course, this also connects us to the global debates in migration studies, where De Genova argues that talks about the legal production of migrant illegality. So this example shows that Russian case is not unique, but it's a part of this global tendencies of this informalization of labor and mobility due to strict legal restrictions and regulations.
And could you talk a little bit more about informal state practices outside of the Russian context? Because I know you just mentioned this kind of refugee movement facilitated Russian state actors, through Finland and Norway, but can you provide some examples of kind of informal practices by state actors, and not in the Russian Federation context, but outside of that? Because I'm curious to hear more about how this Russian case kind of fits into this global context, like you just said.
Yeah, and from my experience, while doing fieldwork in Istanbul in Turkey, I see similar tendencies where this. Legal restrictions, regulations, which is not possible for migrants to observe, creates new avenues of informality. And also, this is not just a Russian or Turkish case, but we can also see similar examples in Western migration regimes. Like, you know, there are studies dealing with informal document industry in United Kingdom. We also see similar tendencies in relation to migrants' experiences in United States. We have studies from Susan Cotin and Cecilia Menjivar and many others, you know, talking about the emergence of informal strategies. So this is more or less, in my view, it's a global tendency that Rano, would you like to add more in this respect?
I mean, that's also, I mean, since we are talking about Central Asia here, so, I mean, in Central Asia is also, I mean, Kupatatsa's work on criminal states, criminalized post-Soviet state, he also talks about Central Asian states and Russian state and Caucasus, examples from Ukraine and Belarus. So, I mean, he has several books on criminal states. So, I mean, this literature is, I mean, is there.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, and also, if we add more, you know, the reason we bring this informality to in this edited volume is to show the parallels and the similar developments in different socio-legal contexts. I think also by focusing on the case of Russia, Central Asia, and Eastern Europe, we wanted to show that these regions should not be seen as a kind of anomalies or examples of islands of informality, but this is more a global tendency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and I think
agree fully with that.
Comes through really well, and hopefully that's what we were highlighting in the interview. Great, I think we are nearing the end of the interview, so I wanted to kind of give you the opportunity, like for listeners, what are the big takeaways that you want them, you know, reflecting on the book, but also reflecting on your kind of broader research, what do they need to know about states, mobility, informality, you know, in the Russian and kind of Central Asian context. And I know we just talked about this a little bit, but a last opportunity to reach the listeners.
If I can start, in my view, one of the main takeaways through these different case studies chapters is that when we analyze, review the mainstream migration studies literature, especially dealing with mobility regimes and legal regulations, they are very much obsessed with migrants' legal status and the role of the law. And then there is a kind of legal centralistic approach that is a tendency to focus on the nation-state legal system as a factor determining the life chances and trajectories of migrants. But the idea is that I am also trying to show in my forthcoming book about migration in Russia and Turkey that we need to broaden our lens and try to incorporate informality, these informal practices that migrants invent in their daily life as a alternative adaptation strategy in uncertain and precarious migration situations, you know, conditions. And that's why I think that's something that as a legal sociologist, I would argue for the necessity to include informal avenues of adaptation.
As an anthropologist, I think I have to say that. As an anthropologist, I really appreciate the anthropological literature on mobility studies, anthropological literature on migration in general, or transnational migration. So I think study of informality, I think anthropologists contributed enough examples into this literature, and I think our book really complements this kind of anthropological approaches to studies of informality and mobilities. where we are kind of giving more perspectives of from actor-oriented perspectives than, as Rustam said rightly, that it's not that the migrants are passive receivers of all these migration policies, but they also have some agency and innovate and contribute to this kind of informal practices, which are very important to understand, in order to understand these very complex processes, I guess.
Great. Thank you both, Ron and Rustam. And thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for sharing some insights onto your really great edited volume. For the listeners, that the title of that volume, again, was Labor Mobility and Informal Practices in Russia, Central Asia, and Eastern Europe, Power, Institutions, and Mobile Actors in Transnational Space, published this year, 2021, with Rutledge. Thanks again for coming to the show, Rano and Rustam.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.